We want to begin today by trying to understand two international stories that have been dominating headlines. In a few minutes, we'll find out the latest in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. That's important because the U.S. and many other analysts believe the Malaysian Airlines flight that was shot down over Ukrainian territory last week was a casualty of that conflict. But first, we turn to the Middle East, where the Israeli ground invasion of Gaza escalated over the weekend. Israeli forces used ships, artillery, and tanks to combat members of Hamas in a border town on Sunday. At least 100 Palestinians were killed in the violence just this weekend, along with 13 Israeli soldiers. Overall, more than 400 people have been killed in this latest conflict, which obviously has very deep roots, but we felt this would be a good opportunity to try to help understand what's going on right now and why. Zach Beecham just tried to do this in a report for his news outlet. He's world correspondent at Vox, and he's with us now in our studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Before we get to the specifics of this, I mean, many people do recall that these three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped, later found killed, and it's understood that a Palestinian teenager was, you know, killed and beaten in retaliation. Is that what set this off, or something else?
In a way, yes. It started with the killing, initially kidnapping of three Israeli teenagers. Israel conducted a manhunt. Possibly they knew the kids were already dead to begin with, to find them. And that arrested a number of Hamas operatives. That triggered rocket fire because it was obviously an operation targeted at Hamas. Then when the Palestinian teenager was killed, as well as his cousin being beaten in Israeli custody, a Palestinian-American, that inflamed Palestinian sentiment further. It led to increased rocket fire. It also led to retaliation from the IDF. The cycle of violence, and to use a cliched phrase, essentially escalated into the ongoing conflict we see right now.
Why is Hamas, again, firing these rockets? That would seem to be a losing strategy, since they are clearly outgunned, as it were, just to use a very simple phrase. They are clearly outgunned. They do not have kind of the level of weaponry and the level of organization of the Israeli government. So what is the strategy behind firing these rockets at this point?
Hamas's political legitimacy depends on the idea of quote-unquote resistance to Israel, that is, of showing that they can stand up and create a sense of agency in response to Israeli military actions. So the rocket fire is their way of saying that we are still resisting the Israeli occupation and the Israeli of the West Bank and the Israeli blockade of Gaza. So this is a domestic political ploy. It's also a targeted strategy, often to extract concessions from particular people. For instance, some very knowledgeable analysts believe that what Hamas is trying to do here is to get Egypt to let more goods into Gaza through the Rafah crossing on the west and to give them more money. The idea is they leverage Egyptian public sentiment, anger at Israel, into Egyptian concessions. And indeed, Egypt signaled today that they're interested in accommodating Hamas terms to broker a ceasefire.
What is the relationship right now between Hamas and Egypt?
Egypt does not like Hamas. The Egyptian military controls the Egyptian government. Because they control the government, they have tried to root out the Muslim Brotherhood, who's the main opposition. In fact, they took over from the Muslim Brotherhood in a coup. Hamas has very close relations with the Muslim Brotherhood, and its charter, it describes itself as the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood. They're separate organizations, but the Egyptian government doesn't trust Hamas at all. They've declared it an illegal organization through the court system and have cracked down on their supply lines, their critical supply lines, their tunnels that go under the Gaza border. As a consequence, Egypt and Hamas are in very tenuous terms.
What has been the response to the rising death toll, both in Gaza, in the region, and internationally among key players, especially kind of the disproportionate nature of the casualties? I mean, obviously, all deaths, especially of innocents, is you know, regrettable and terrifying. But what's been the response to this rising death toll?
Well, there's been widespread international anger.
At whom?
Principally, one would say probably at Israel. In fact, if you look at, take social media as a barometer, you saw a disproportionate number of tweets about, relative to, you know, there being two sides, criticizing Israel versus criticizing Hamas in the operation. So there's been a lot of demonstrations against Israel. The U.S., has been supportive of the air campaign in Gaza, but it also has been quite critical of the ground escalation, or at least more critical than it usually is. The U.S. always couches its criticism of Israel in sort of very moderate terms. And so Obama on Sunday, gave his most important statement or most serious concern about civilian casualties in Gaza.
Well, he called to that end, this is the final question, he called for an immediate ceasefire after the violence on Sunday. The U.N. has also urged an end to the violence. Are these appeals relevant? Is there any relevant actor here?
Well, it's hard to say right now. Secretary Kerry is in Cairo right now, probably working with the Egyptian government to facilitate another ceasefire operation or offer, which is what Egypt had done previously. So it's possible the U.S. could help broker a deal, but it's hard to be optimistic right now in the short term, given the escalation in conflict.
Recognize this is a very complicated issue. Thank you for making it as simple as possible. Zach Beauchamp with Vox, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to turn now to the other international hotspot that's in the news. That's the ongoing issue in Ukraine, or power struggle in Ukraine. The conflict went back to the top of the headlines when Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over Ukrainian territory on Thursday. Pro-Russian rebels are in control of the area and are widely suspected of shooting down the plane. International officials have accused the separatists of interfering with the search and the investigation at the crash site, and the incident has put Russian President Vladimir Putin, who's backed the rebel movement, on the defensive. We wanted to know more about this, so we've called upon F. Stephen Larrabee, Distinguished Chair in European Security at the RAND Corporation. Welcome to you as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Just tell us, if you would, the latest about what Russian President Vladimir Putin's stance is here. We understand that he's called for a ceasefire between the rebels and the Ukrainian government, but does he really mean it?
Well, it's very hard to tell. The most important fact is that his image has been very badly damaged, because the United States and the Ukrainians' government have what seems to be overwhelming circumstantial evidence that the Russians, in fact, supplied the missile and trained the secessionists to fire it, so that he's certainly seen as being co-culpable.
What would have been the motivation for this?
Well, it goes back to basically November of last year, when the Ukrainian government wanted to sign a trade and association agreement with the EU. President Putin put a lot of pressure on then-president of Ukraine, Yanukovych, not to sign it. At the last second, he withdrew his signature, which then started a number of protests. Protests spiraled, and then Yanukovych was forced to resign. And since then, we've had this situation where the Russians have used a group of secessionists on the territory of Ukraine. Most of these secessionists, however, have Russian citizenship and have been fighting in various conflicts on Russian territory. So it's really a pro-Russian group led by Russians.
What would have been the motivation, though, for bringing down that airliner?
They thought, as best as one can tell, the secessionists thought that they had shot down a Ukrainian government transport plane, and they bragged about it. But then they realized afterwards that, in fact, had been a commercial airliner, and that all the bravado and statements were taken off the social media when they realized that what they'd done.
Does it appear that Russian President Putin does it appear that he has any leverage or influence with this group?
Oh, he has a lot of influence. He's trained, financed, and supported the group. So if he wanted it to go away, he could make it go away tomorrow or at 2 o'clock today, anytime.
What conclusion should we then draw from what we're hearing so far about the fact that these rebels, these separatists, are interfering with international monitors who are trying to investigate the crash? What conclusion should we draw from that?
Well, it makes it look as if they have something to hide, which by all circumstantial evidence seems to be the case. But we have to wait to see what an international independent inquiry will come up with, to be sure.
Is there any international pressure that can be brought to bear here? We already know that the relations between the U.S. and Russia are quite frayed right now, that they're kind of banning each other's individuals and putting various restrictions on key players in each government and so forth. Does any individual have... I guess what the question is, what should we be looking for next to see what direction this conflict will go to?
Well, whatever Putin does, the most important thing would be if he would disown the the rebels and cut off their supply of weapons and other assistance, particularly these surface-to-air missiles.
Is there any indication he's so inclined, and what would make him do that? What are the levers that would be influential
with him?
Public
opinion, basically, because it now seems that whether he's guilty or not, in the eyes of most of the public, they think that he's responsible for this, since he's trained, not he personally, but his government, trained and financed the rebels and provided them with the rocket that apparently downed the plane.
Can I ask you for your personal opinion before we let you go? What's your sure. your concern about this escalating into a conflict beyond the region? Do you have concerns about that?
Well, I don't know whether it'll go beyond the region, but it certainly has very destabilizing aspects. And the fact is that this secessionist, so-called, the separatists, are a ragtag mercenary army financed by Russia, which has done that clandestinely. Mm-hmm. And now you see the danger that this could escalate very much into maybe a regional war, but okay. I don't think anything beyond that, but still.
I understand. Thank you so much. Stephen Larrabee is the Distinguished Chair in European Security at the RAND Corporation. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Mr. Larrabee, thank you so much for speaking.
Thank you.
To bring you two conversations now from two very different women who've each in their own way had an enormous influence on the way we live our lives today. In a minute, we'll hear from the author and conservative icon Phyllis Schlafly. Her campaign against the Equal Rights Amendment for women had impact far beyond that legislative fight. But first, we hear from gay rights activist Madeline Davis. You might have heard that an appeals court last week struck down the ban on same-sex marriage in Oklahoma. That's just one more example of the prominence of gay rights issues in the public sphere today. But in the early 1970s, neither of the two major political parties wanted to have anything to do with that issue. That is, until Madeline Davis fought for platform language defending the civil rights of gay people during the Democratic National Convention in 1972. I spoke with her during the 2012 Democratic Convention, and I started by asking her how she prepared herself to go public.
There was looking at myself in the mirror and saying, this is where you're leading your life. And I called my mother and said, guess what? My latest lover is a woman. And she said, oh, Madeline, you've done everything else. You know, it's like, that was the end of it. And she met my subsequent girlfriends, and my grandmother did, and the whole family was okay. And it just became a part of my life. So when this came along, I thought, well, you know, this is really not going to happen. They don't vote for lesbians. And then they did.
And you were there. You went to Miami Beach. Now, I understand that you actually have a copy of your speech, your historic speech, with you.
I do.
Do you mind reading a little bit?
If you would like, you can actually hear it.
Oh.
I have the CD.
Okay.
With Walter Cronkite introducing me.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The speaker who just started is Madeline Davis, a 32-year-old communications worker from Buffalo, New York, who just identified herself as a lesbian. Let's listen.
Opportunity to speak to you. 20 million Americans are grateful and proud of the Democratic Party. We are the minority of minorities. We belong to every race and creed, both sexes, every economic and social level, every nationality and religion. We live in large cities and in small towns, but we are the untouchables in American society. We have suffered the gamut of oppression, from being totally ignored or ridiculed to having our heads smashed and our blood spilled in the streets. Now we are coming out of our closets and onto the convention floor to tell you, the delegates, and to tell all gay people throughout America that we are here to put an end to our fears that people will know us for who we are, that they will shun and revile us, fire us from our jobs, reject us from our families, evict us from our homes, beat us and jail us. And for what? Because we have chosen to love each other. I am asking that you vote yes for the inclusion of this minority report into the Democratic platform for two major reasons. First, we must speak to the basic civil rights of all human beings. It is inherent in the American tradition that the private lives and lifestyles of citizens should be both allowed and insured, so long as they do not infringe upon the rights of others. A government that interferes with the private lives of its people is a government that is alien to the American tradition and the American dream. You have before you a chance to reaffirm that tradition and that dream. As a matter of practicality, you also have the opportunity to gain the vote of 20 million Americans that will help in November to put a Democrat in the White House.
How did you feel when it was over?
I felt like I was on another planet. But some very nice things happened to me. I came down off the podium, and the first thing that happened was this extremely tall, sort of Hispanic-looking man came up to me. He was wearing all black. And he hugged me, and he said, "You did such a great job. I'm going to take your cause back to my people and make sure that it's something that we deal with, because it's not something we've ever really thought about before." And then he took a little pin, a Thunderbird pin, off of his lapel, and he pinned it onto my blouse and said, "Thank you very much." And he walked away, and I had no idea who he was. And so I asked, and someone told me that he was Cesar Chavez's cousin, who had invented the Thunderbird pin for the United Farm Workers.
Wow.
So that was the first incident. And there were things like that that happened all through that convention.
After you spoke, a female delegate from Ohio rebutted your proposed plank. And then in her remarks, she connected homosexuality with prostitution and pedophilia. And then your plank was defeated. What was your takeaway from all of that?
We knew right away, we meaning the Gay and Lesbian Caucus, we were pretty disgusted about the way she did it. We knew, of course, that there was going to be someone who would speak against it. But the way it was done, the words that were used, were pretty horrible. And we wrote a letter of protest. And she wrote a letter saying she was sorry. I have it. Her name was Kathy Welch, and she was from Ohio. And she said, "I opposed the plank for reasons of political expediency. The analogies I drew in the speech were aimed to show the possible ramifications of the plank as a political document. I was not aware that the speech would imply that homosexuals are child molesters. Child molestation is largely a heterosexual, not homosexual problem. I heartily apologize to all members of the gay liberation movement for any other implications which were derived from my speech. And, oh, I will do all in my power to urge Senator McGovern to publicly repudiate the statement as prepared by the platform committee staff and to publicly reaffirm his support for gay civil rights." Well, of course, that wasn't going to happen.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's
layer
upon layer of backstory there. Before we say goodbye, I'd like to ask you the question that we've been asking most of our guests during the last 2 weeks of political conventions, which is, what does a successful country look like?
It is much less angry than this one is. It looks like spring. It looks like hope.
That was gay rights activist Madeline Davis. I spoke with her during the 2012 Democratic National Convention. In case you didn't know, Davis didn't just fight this fight in politics. She was also a singer-songwriter in her own right. What you're hearing now is her tribute to the LGBT movement, a song called Stonewall Nation.
I see you can make your tolerance and shove it. We're gonna be all right.
And now we're going to hear from a woman with a very different take on things. Phyllis Schlafly is without a doubt a conservative icon. She's a mother, a lawyer, a columnist, an author, a radio host. One of her biggest achievements, though, was her campaign to stop the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment in the early 1970s. Here's a clip of her talking about this in 1973.
Since the women are the ones who bear the babies and there's nothing we can do about that, our laws and customs then make it the financial obligation of the husband to provide the support. It is his obligation and his sole obligation. And this is exactly and precisely what we will lose if the Equal Rights Amendment is passed.
And in part thanks to her, it wasn't. The amendment fell short by 3 states, largely due to her grassroots campaigning. She didn't stop there, though. I spoke with her in 2011 about what was her latest book at the time, The Flip Side of Feminism, and I started by asking her when she became a critic of the movement.
When I went to the hearings for the Equal Rights Amendment and I heard what they were saying, and they had absolutely no benefit to offer women, but we could see a lot of disadvantages in it.
What is it that you saw that made you feel that way?
What that amendment would do is to make all laws sex neutral. Well, the typical classic law that is not sex neutral is the draft registration law. And we were still in the Vietnam War in 1972. I had sons and daughters about age 18. My daughters thought this was the craziest thing they ever heard. You're going to have a new amendment for women, and the first thing is they'll have to sign up for the draft like their brothers. Now, that was an unsaleable proposition.
Is it true that you took the bar exam wearing a disguise so that you wouldn't be inundated
well, yes.
by the media?
My children didn't want me to take the bar exam because they were afraid that if I failed, like Ted Kennedy, it would be on the front page. So I wore the black wig and went up, and nobody recognized me the first day. But the second day of the exam, when I left, I walked right into the arms of a Chicago Tribune photographer and reporter.
And you did pass.
Oh, yes, of course I passed.
How did you manage, though, as a mother of six, as your husband was certainly had a busy career of his own, and being as significant a national figure as you have been, how did you manage?
Well, politics was my hobby, and I really spent 25 years as a full-time homemaker before I did any particular traveling around. And by that time, the children were well along in school or college, and they were very supportive. My husband was very supportive. I told the feminists the only person's permission I had to get was my husband's.
Talk a little bit about the new book, if you would. What is it, your message in this book that you feel is particularly current for today?
A lot of people don't understand what feminism is. They think it is about advance and success for women, but it's not that at all. It is about power for the female left. And they have this, I think, ridiculous idea that American women are oppressed by the patriarchy, and we need laws and government to solve our problems for us. They have made their close alliance with the Obama administration, and they're always crying around about things like the differences between men and women are just a social construct, so they're really in a fight with human nature. I would not want to be called a feminist. The feminists don't believe in success for women. And of course, I believe that American women are the most fortunate people who ever lived on the face of the earth, can do anything they make up their minds to do.
Do you feel that feminism has made any contribution to American life?
No, I think it's made women unhappy. It's make them believe that we live in a discriminatory and unjust society and that they should look to government to solve their problems.
What is your advice to the young women in your family, and the men for that matter?
Well, I think, as we say in the book, that it's unfortunate that colleges and women's studies courses guide women to a career path that has no space for men, marriage, or children. And I think you should plot a life that will give you the joy of marriage and children.
You know, I hear many young men say that they want careers that will allow them to more fully enjoy family life, too.
Well, I think so. But they find some of the women say they don't want to take care of their own babies. I don't know why a man would marry a woman like that. I tell the college kids they ought to find out if the girl they're dating is a feminist or not.
I guess what I was asking is what I hear a lot of young men say that they want the same thing. They want careers that will allow them to enjoy family life as well. Is that wrong?
No, it's not wrong, but I do think that gender roles are valid. We do look to the men to be providers and protectors. Now, there's some people who successfully plan it another way, and they don't have to get my permission to do that. They simply yes, have ma'am. To find a young man who wants to do that.
Can I ask you about race for a minute? There is a very large percentage of out-of-wedlock birth in the black community. But African-American women, on the whole, are not terribly supportive of the feminist movement, have not been kind of strongly identified with it, do embrace marriage, don't embrace a lot of the anti-male rhetoric that you're so critical of. And yet, marriage is not as prominent in our community, in the African-American community, as it was even in 1959. I'm just curious why you think that. So in 1959, for example, African-Americans were more likely to be married than whites were, but now it's the reverse. And I'm just wondering if you have an opinion about that.
Yes, and you realize it's not poverty that's caused that, because all during the Great Depression, the black family was intact and together, and they didn't have these handouts. I think when Lyndon Johnson instituted lavish welfare, they gave the money only to the woman, and that made the father irrelevant. He lacked his role, his duty as a provider, so he took off. And that is just simply so unfortunate. The illegitimacy rate is now getting very large, even across the board, among the white people. And it's too bad, because we know that most of the social ills come out of mother-headed households. So if you're asking me for the cause, it doesn't really have anything to do with race. It has to do with the financial subsidies that were given to women, making the father provider irrelevant.
As we mentioned, this is a Wisdom Watch conversation, so we always like to end by asking, do you have some wisdom that you want to share?
Well, yes, I would say, don't be taken in by feminism. Just remember, American women are so fortunate. When I got married, all I wanted in the world was a dryer, so I didn't have to hang up my diapers. And now women have paper diapers and all sorts of conveniences in the home, and it is the men and the technology that has made the home such a pleasant place for women to be. So I hope they will use that pleasant place to raise their children.
That was the conservative author and activist Phyllis Schlafly speaking to me in 2011. If you've been following the program, then you know we have a very deep interest in technology, how it's created, how it's used, and how it affects the country. We've been particularly interested in groups that haven't had as much access to this vital area. In our Women in Tech and Blacks in Tech series on Twitter and on the radio, we've been able to experience in real time the impact of so-called minorities and women are making on this country's science and technology engine. And I think it's fair to say that the engagement we generated, close to 200 million impressions on Twitter, demonstrates the incredible appetite for knowledge about the contributions of these thought leaders, entrepreneurs, and scientists. And as our program winds down, you know, our last program is August 1st, we wanted to touch base on some of these important issues at least one more time. So we've called upon Ben Jealous. He is the former president and CEO of the NAACP. He recently joined Caper Capital. It is a Bay Area group that invests in social impact tech startups. He's with us now in our Washington, D.C. studios. Once again, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
In your new incarnation. James Oliver Jr. is the founder of WeMontage and was part of our Blacks in Tech series. He joins us from WHID, which is in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome back to you, Mr. Oliver.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And also joining us, entrepreneur Francesca Escoto of Latina Startup Tour. She joined us from WUSF, which is in Tampa, Florida. Francesca Escoto, welcome to you as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Ben Jealous, let me start with you. When you left the NAACP this past spring to join Caper Capital, does this tie into your civil rights background in some way, or is this just a fresh start for you?
You know, look, I think it's both. I think it's both and. I think, like most people the first 10 years of my professional life, I excelled because I was willing to do things that were new every day if possible. And in the second decade, I excelled because I found a few things I was better at the most and was willing to do them over and over. So this is exciting to me personally because it's an opportunity to do something in a new way, but it's something I've been doing for a long time, which is trying to figure out fairly simple ways to solve big social problems for hundreds of thousands or millions of people. And some of the issues that we're dealing with at KCAP are precisely the same that I dealt with at the NAACP, but we're finding more effective ways to actually move the ball forward. I'll give, you know,
just give me one example.
Sure. The cost of inmates calling home is something that I was dealing with the FCC on for years, and we just never seem to get very far because there's a whole lot of profit in it. It can cost up to $3 per minute. Per minute to call home, depending on where you are. So at KCAP, we've supported a guy named Frederick, and Frederick has a company called Pigeonly, and Pigeonly has disrupted the market for inmates calling home from first federal prisons and now state prisons dramatically, dropping the cost by about 90%.
So you don't have to go through the whole regulatory hoops and the
That's
legislative
exactly
hoops.
Right.
You
mean,
can
just,
find a technological solution to this problem.
You just took Google Voice type technology and used it to help folks who are in prison get a phone number that is local to their prison but connected to their home thousands of miles away and cut the cost of calling home by about 90% in the process. You know, similarly, we have company up in Washington Heights called Regali. They've cut the cost of people sending money home to a foreign country, but also by about 90% versus Western Union, and made it safer. You know, in the past, look, and even for many people right now, when they want to send money home, say, to the Dominican Republic, it costs them about 30%, but also, you know, their grandmother who's waiting is waiting in a storefront window where people have her marked the moment she walks out and they know she has cash in her pocket. What Regali has done is cut that cost, but also made it possible to transfer the funds on the cell phone.
Okay. I think we got it. One of the other efforts that the KPRO Center is supporting is an effort to take tech tools directly to Latino communities around the country. Francesca Escoto is part of that. So, Francesca, why don't you tell us about the Latina Startup Tour?
Absolutely. First of all, thank you to KPOR for what they're doing. They're very intentional about identifying talent in communities of color and supporting it through both development training, but also financially. What the Latina Startup Tour aims to do, we're reaching 800 women in 8 cities in 2014, and the goal is to bring the training to them. We deal with both a gap in technology access, but also language access. And so there's a lot of lingo that is built up in whether you call them accelerators, incubators, whatever, throughout Silicon Valley. Well, that doesn't reach our communities and it doesn't reach them in a language or at an academic level that they can fully grasp. And so we are taking that on the road and we're making sure that we bring that to Latinas. We are the fastest growing entrepreneur segment in the U.S. We are starting businesses at a faster pace than any other group. And what we're trying to do is bring awareness to these Latina mothers, in many cases, and recent immigrants that, you know, you make a dress, you're a seamstress, you make 50 dresses, you're a really good seamstress, you make 100 dresses, you're into garment manufacturing.
So what's the plan here? Is the plan to allow, to give people, you know, opportunities to understand how technology can improve their existing businesses? Is it to try to encourage people to encourage their children to pursue STEM careers? What's the goal of this immediate project
here? The goal here is to help Latinas see themselves not only as users but also creators of technology, and to see their businesses as opportunities to embrace technology and to become partakers of the tech startup economy.
Okay. James Oliver Jr., you were part of our Blacks in Tech series back in December of 2013, and I do want to hear about your company and what you're doing, but I'm also I'm really interested in this whole question of what the whole question of diversity in the tech field and what makes a difference in getting more people of different backgrounds into this field. So briefly, I understand that WeMontage, am I pronouncing it properly?
Yeah, you are.
And tell me what you do. You can create what, big wall display art with family photos, right?
Kind of, yeah. So it's the only website on the internet that I know of that will let you take your pictures and turn them into large custom photo collages on removable wallpaper.
And that's particularly helpful if you have, say, family members who are in assisted living or nursing homes or something like that. So
jog
their memories. It's also of a size where it's easy to see.
Yeah, mm-hmm. College dorm students as well. Exactly. Just, you know, really any place you want to display photos or you can't put nails in the wall, like people living in military housing, when they move out, they have to pay move out fees for putting nails in the wall. But anybody who's a picture enthusiast, it's an affordable alternative to things like popular canvas wraps, as well as picture frames, which are incredibly expensive for custom framing.
What gave you the idea for this? I'm just wondering, and forgive me if I don't mean to be, you know, crude about it, but do you think that your background had something to do with your own identity, had something to do with what gave you the idea?
Oh, my God, no. It was actually my wife was watching an interior design show on television, and they were in the basement covering the wall with these big black and white beautiful collages. And for me, that was really a moment of inspiration. And I say inspiration, I mean that in, like, the spiritual sense. It was, like, a huge aha moment for me. But in terms of, you know, why I thought I could do that, my background is not tech-oriented. I'm the guy that wants to start a tech company but doesn't know how to write a line of code. But I would attribute that to my mom, who taught me ever since I was a kid that I could do whatever I put my mind to. And then, you know, I went to Morehouse College. I mean, graduated a million years ago. I'm not going to say when. But, you know, going to Morehouse, they instill in you a certain confidence. And I think, you know, a combination of my mom and it's just something that's really stubborn about me. Maybe it's because I'm a tourist and I just believe that I can, you know, persist and get these things done.
Ben, I was going to go back to this whole question of the diversity in the field. And sure. Why do you think this – why does it matter?
Well, you know, it gets actually what he was just talking about, which is that it's not so much about identity as it is about your lived life, what you experience. People solve the problems that they see. When you talk about, you know, somebody who starts a new business, it's because they're trying to scratch their own itch. And so if you're in San Francisco, there is – not just one startup, there are probably 10 startups for every problem that a rich person has. If you go across the bridge to Oakland, where we have our offices, mm-hmm. there's a whole bunch of problems waiting to be solved, and there's not even one startup to solve them. What you see with a Pigeonly, with a Regali, even with a WeMontage, is somebody seeing something that most of the folks who are of the class, if you will, starting startups these days, don't see. Mm. And for us...
So they wouldn't necessarily think about what it's like to have to pay a fee to take something off the walls. So it wouldn't necessarily occur to them that this is a problem.
Because when
or they wouldn't necessarily understand.
Heights, yeah. you don't pay a fee for taking something off the walls, right? But the key point here is that there's profit in that because most people are like the people in Oakland, if you will.
And
not like the people in Pack Heights and increasingly throughout San Francisco.
Francesca, you wanted to say something?
Well, yeah, I'm like bursting here. That's exactly it. What happens is we are solving problems. We're just not calling it technology. And so we are marginalized to some extent, either by self or society. I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into that, but we are solving problems. We're not calling it what it is. And so we're not participating in all the full extent of this economy. So what we're doing, and I think that it's the same thing that the other gentlemen are talking about, what we're doing is, okay, you don't know how to code. Guess what? It's okay, because you can still solve this problem. Mm-hmm. There are people who can code. What you need to bring to the table is the idea. You need to bring the problem and we'll help you get the tools and the resources to solve the problem.
James, what about you? And I'm also particularly interested in whether you feel as an African-American entrepreneur that are there obstacles for you that don't exist for others like you? I mean, for example, is it a question of whether you put your own picture on your website?
Oh, that's a great question. Just circling back to what she said, I think she's right. And fortunately for me, I was really fortunate enough to get into a tech accelerator in Wisconsin called Generator. And, you know, they were very helpful in helping me bring the idea to the market with access to resources, credibility, et cetera, and raising capital. But, yeah, I mean, there are a couple of things that I think about that I don't think the average entrepreneur thinks about. Like, for example, like you said, on our website, our twins who, you know, have African-American twins who are just beautiful. They're 18 months old. Well, I think they're beautiful. And that's the feature image on the website. And I just, you know, I wonder sometimes if, you know, could that be hurting my business? You know, I don't know, but I'm not changing it because I love my kids.
I hear you. They are gorgeous. Let me give a final thought to Ben Jealous here. Could you tell us, I promised I'd ask you about the impact generation. What does that mean?
You know, look, we have a rising generation in this country that's totally wired, that knows that they can make a huge profit, but that also wants to make the world better at the same time. And, you know, I have faith that that generation will ultimately get sort of capitalism in our country back to what it was supposed to be a long time ago, when it was about people in villages making the most of their possibilities. Back then, if you will, who you were, your reputation had something to do with whether or not you were successful. Today, you actually have to be very intentional if you want to bring sort of who you are and what you're about and how you make money into one place.
All right. Well, let's hear more about this in the future. We hope we'll be talking more about this in the future. I'm speaking with Ben Jealous of the Kapor Center for Social Impact and Kapor Capital, former president and CEO of the NAACP. James Oliver Jr. is the founder of WeMontage. Francesca Escoto of Latino Startup Tour. They were all here with us today. Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And this social media note, you can follow our conversations on Twitter and Facebook at NPR Michelle. And finally, as we mentioned, our last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st. So as we wind down our production, we thought it would be nice to hear about the music that members of our staff are listening to as part of our regular series, In Your Ear. This Monday, we thought we'd hear from our summer intern, Miles Johnson. And here's what's on his playlist.
Hi, I'm Miles, and this is what's playing in my ear. Good Enough by XXYYXX is amazing. It's a song that I think is important and a song that I play a lot because of its context. He is a young black electronic musician, which is rare, and he's sampling TLC, which I think is even rarer for that genre of music, and it's fun. So another song that's playing in my ear and has been for a while now is Warm Winds by SZA and Isaiah Rashad.
Hey, hey, Glory Child. Hey. Hey, Glory Child, don't you worry. Stuttering, shaking off fear. Beauty's never given for you.
These are two really young artists who have recorded this song together, and even though the latter is a rapper, SZA is this really unique, unconventional artist, and she has this really different voice. I always think, you know, she reminds me of someone, and it's almost on the tip of my tongue, but I could never really place it, and I feel like that's what really draws me to her music as a whole. She does sound so different, and I always feel really relaxed listening to this song, especially, but really captivated by this just different, interesting sounding voice.
Come on today. You could come on today.
Experiment Black Radio.
Another song playing in my ear right now is Black Radio by Robert Glasper. Even though Yasiin Bey, who many people will know better as Mos Def, is the only voice you hear on the track, Robert Glasper plays all the instruments and does all the production, so it's really his song. And I feel like the reason this has always resonated, it does a great job of allowing hip-hop to sort of come out of this box that I feel like it gets put in often. It's still a secret even when you tell them dumb dummies. Hush money, rent receipt, drug money, the cold blooded warm gun money, the chief rock a fuel injector, Zulu horse, proper dog, boogie, bay, 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 bay. And though, you know, there is rapping on this track, it's not your typical hip-hop track. But then again, like, what is typical? And I think that that is what makes this unique. I think that's what Robert Glasper really did well, was really make an interesting sort of track that makes you think a little bit differently about music and the way that we categorize it. You are rocking with the fresh. Yes, you are rocking with the best. You are rocking with the fresh. You are rocking with the depth. You are rocking with the yes. Now you are rocking with the best. You're rocking with the fresh, you are rocking with your depth, it's the yes.
That was Tell Me More intern Miles Johnson telling us what's playing in his ear.